No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. That's BBS Radio 1. Tonight, we have a very special guest, Kevin Hines. Kevin is going to share his life-changing story with us, and we're glad to have him on the show, and I think that you'll find this particularly interesting, and I can't wait to talk to him. But before we get started, I just want to say a few things about what's been going on lately in the District of Columbia. There really is not a lot on the statehood front. We've lost a couple of statehood advocates in the last few weeks, notably Ivanhoe Donaldson, who was a civil rights leader and a leader in the District of Columbia for many years, and also Jerry Clark, who was a statehood supporter. So our condolences go out to their families, and we will miss them in our movement. In addition to that, next week is Emancipation Day, and we're going to have a guest on next weekend to talk about Emancipation Day. Emancipation Day is the only official holiday in the District of Columbia. It's the time when Abraham Lincoln, in kind of a PR effort to abolish slavery, bought all 3,000 plus slaves in the District of Columbia and set them free. It's the one day that we celebrate in the district as a local holiday, and it is the only conceded emancipation in American history. So tune in next week, because it's really, really interesting thing. Not a lot of people know about Emancipation Day, but it's a big deal here in the District of Columbia. The President of the United States used to come out and march in a parade with us. It's been a while since this happened, but we'll have a parade and other things next week to report on, so please tune in. Without further delay, my charming and lovely host, Maria Sanchez, will introduce you to us.
Thank you, Michael, and it's great to be here, as always, every Sunday at 4 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time and 7 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, and of course, available for download and on demand at BBS Radio, as well as iTunes and some of the other places. And Michael, you're cutting in and out, so the studio is going to call you on your cell phone to speak, but I'd like to welcome, and with great pleasure and an honor, Kevin Hines. Kevin belongs to an elite group of folks, 34, in fact, to be exact, unless I'm wrong with my latest information. Kevin is a survivor of a jump from the Golden Gate Bridge on September 24th in the year 2000 at 19 years of age. Kevin, I have had the honor to meet in person and to interview him prior to this broadcast. And Kevin, thank you so much for making yourself available. I know how busy you are. In fact, you are not in your normal home in California. You are in the state of Pennsylvania, if I'm correct, Kevin.
That's right. Hi, Maria. It's so good to talk to you again. Thank you both for having me on the show.
You're so welcome,
Kevin. I'm in Pennsylvania for the next week or so, traveling around these areas to spread a message of hope, because, Maria, we know that hope helps heal. and it helps people find recovery. If they can realize that they, the suicidal deserve to live, and that they are indeed cared for and loved, and if they can realize that they can fight the pain from within, the enemy within, as my friend Joe Williams calls it, they can get better. And when they realize they can get better, they can change their lives. And all it takes is a glimmer of hope.
So, Kevin, before we get into some of the statistics and some of the hopeful messages that you have been promoting as a mental health advocate, and also the book that you have written and the documentary and then the other production that you have going on, and the senator is able to join us now. He's been reconnected. Kevin, will you share your story, please?
Yeah, please.
Absolutely. Senator, thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks for being on.
Oh, I'm glad to. And so, my story, I actually just told it to the University of Pittsburgh about 30 minutes ago. I have bipolar disorder. Quite frankly, a very severe form. I was diagnosed with it at 17 and a half years of age. My first symptom was paranoia, extreme paranoia. I went from experiencing extreme paranoia to having hallucinations, both auditory and visual, to manic delusions of grandeur, to falling into these pits of deep and dark depression, and then panic attacks and anxiety issues and stress. And then if you just press repeat, it just kept happening over and over and over again. It led me to attempt to take my life. And yes, I did. I did jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. But Maria, you know, and Senator, that's not the important part of the story. I think the important piece of the story is that it was at the millisecond that my hands left that rail. And I've repeated this many times, but it still remains true. The millisecond my hands left that rail, I was what some suicidologists would call shocked into reality from my psychosis, from the voices telling me I had to die. And I had an instant regret. In the moments that I fell, those 4 seconds, I wished and prayed I hadn't done it, and I thought it was too late.
Can I ask you how old you were, Kevin, when you did this?
Sure, I was 19. I was 19. A baby. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Been since 2000, so almost 16 years in September.
That's right.
And Kevin, let's talk about a couple of miracles, if you will, that occurred when you landed.
Oh, you bet. Well, first of all, I call them my three miracles. I've always called them that. The first is that when I went over the rail, a woman happened to be driving by in a red car, and she happened to call her good friend when she saw me go over the rail. And her good friend was a United States Coast Guard officer manning the Golden Gate Bridge at the time. And that's the reason that the Coast Guard arrived to my position in the water before I set in hypothermia and drowned. I know that story because she and the man in the Coast Guard happened to be great friends with my high school band teacher, Mr. Blount. And that's how I got to find out that story, that piece of the story that I would have never found out otherwise. It happened to be very, very connected to me personally, as he was a teacher of mine in high school. And so from that point in the water, as I finally resurfaced, and, you know, I was really just in desperation to stay afloat. I kept going under. I thought I was going to drown. I thought there were, you know, who's going to come save me in the water as I flailed around, something began circling beneath me. And I'm thinking, oh, come on. I didn't die off of that bridge. And now, of course, a shark is going to eat me. Now, I didn't know if there were sharks under that bridge or not, but that's not the point. This creature was beneath me, circling. I'm just waiting for it to, you know, bite off a leg or something. But it never did. It just ended up allowing me to not have to wade in the water anymore with my hands, this creature was bumping me up, keeping me afloat. At one point, I was just lying on my back atop the water, being very carefully and very gently pushed up. I was some time later, after I started speaking about this story publicly, I was on a television show called Primetime Live with that host John Quinones on ABC, who does that show, What Would You Do? I'll never forget it. And I said on the show, I thought there was a shark beneath me at one point. And people wrote into the show as it went online from all over the world. Army gentlemen from Italy wrote in. People wrote in from all over. One man wrote in, and he said, "Kevin, I'm so very glad you're alive. I was standing less than 2 feet away from you when you jumped. No one would tell me if you lived or died until I saw this show. It has haunted me until now. By the way, there was no shark, but there was a sea lion."
And the sea lion kept you buoyant.
Yeah, and then he said, "And I have pictures." I was blown away. And so my father had him send the pictures over, but they were so, they were so morbid. My father almost fell out of his chair when he saw them. He was looking at his computer. The thing is, you know, old PCs used to do, it opened on his full screen, and my dad had a big computer screen. It opens on his big screen, and there he sees this. I mean, I have to be honest, I looked like I was dead in the water, and it upset him so much. You know, so the third piece of the miracle is that when the Coast Guard boat arrived behind me and this creature took off from underneath me, one of the Coast Guard officers named Marcus Butler, who's in the film Suicide the Ripple Effect, we tracked him down. He remembers looking at me in the water and saying, "Guys, he's swimming, he's alive," and being so freaked out that I was not dead. One of the younger officers just got right in the water and threw me on the flatboard. And you know, it's my understanding you're supposed to check for injuries of any kind and be very careful with the body, but they were so blown away that I was still living, they just had to get me out of the water. And at that point, I got onto a flatboard and put in a neck brace and all that. And the Coast Guard officer spoke first said, "Kid, do you know what you just did?" And I talk about this in my speech, about my pathetic answer, and about how, you know, the guy looked at me, I said, "Yeah, I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge." And then they said, "Why?" And this is the key here, why? That elusive question that we ask when someone dies by suicide, that question that never seems to get answered for those we have lost. And you know what I said? I said, "I don't know. I thought I had to die."
Kevin, what injuries did you sustain?
Well, upon hitting free fall, I shattered my T12, L1, and L2 lower vertebrae into shards, kind of like glass, and some of it turned into like dust, like powder. It was crushed. It says in the medical records that I missed severing my spinal cord by probably less than 2 centimeters, probably 1 centimeter, if I can remember correctly. And I mean, can you imagine a centimeter? The odds of that are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, and when I got to the ambulance, and the ambulance took me to the hospital, the third piece of the miracle was that the doctor who performed my back surgery, a back surgery that is in a medical journal because the first of its kind, he invented it to help me stay walking. He wasn't supposed to be there that day. Oh. And yet there he was. And there he created a surgery on the fly that saved me the ability to walk, and I can run. It's my understanding that of the, and Maria, just to let you know, the number is now 36 have survived.
Okay. Thank you.
That's fine. And, I was number 26 of that 36. And it's my understanding that I am of a handful that have regained full mobility. But another important point is that 19 of the 36 who have come forward in some sense have stated that when they went over the rail, they knew they made a mistake or they'd had an instant regret just like me.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, Kevin, that's the part of the thing that perplexes me when I hear about your amazing story is that, you know, I've suffered with depression, obviously not the kind of things that you've had to deal with, but is there something that you can pinpoint that drove you to take that step off that bridge and try to take your life in such a dramatic fashion?
Well, you see, Senator, it wasn't dramatic to me. Mm-hmm. It was a means to an end. I was in so much pain in my head, hearing voices telling me, okay, screaming in my head, you have to die, jump now. Mm-hmm. Screaming that I was useless, that I was a burden to everyone who loved me. And that they thought I'd be better off dead, and that they'd be, and I thought that they'd be better off without me. So it wasn't dramatic to me. It was just about stopping the throbbing noise in my head. And I got to a point in my mental instability where I had not slept in days, which causes psychosis, we know. Add that to my diagnosis. I was an absolute wreck. I didn't think I would be hurting any of my family or friends. I thought that's what they wanted because of my distorted reality. And that's what I mean by going over that rail and being shocked into reality from my psychosis and realizing, what have I just done? I don't want to die. God, please save me. And then hitting the water.
Kevin, one of the dramatic things about your story that I find personally empowering and is making me, ever since you and I first met, try and be different or outside the norm of what we consider conventional behavior with one another. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that on your journey to the Golden Gate Bridge and in your pain and while you were suffering and crying, you said that if anybody, any one person reached out to you to touch you, to touch base with you, to comfort you, to provide some sympathy for you, that you wouldn't have jumped.
That's right, Maria. And for those of you who don't know listening at home, it's very common for suicidal individuals to say to themselves, it's almost like they're making a pact with themselves. And the pacts usually go like this. If one person does or says this, I will. And if one person does or says this, I won't die by suicide today. It's so common, in fact, that it's written about. And people can't quite grasp the understanding of it. Even doctors who study the field don't quite comprehend its totality. But yes, people make pacts with themselves. If one person does this or says that, I won't go over, I won't jump, I won't die. My pact was that on that bus ride to the bridge, if one person says to me, hey kid, are you okay? Is something wrong? Or can I help you? I would have told them everything.
Well, let me ask you something.
And I would have begged for their help.
Kevin, is there something instructive in what you've just said? I mean, I've read about, you know, how the Golden Gate Bridge has attracted jumpers for years, and I know that they take all sorts of precautions. They try to take precautions against that sort of thing. Should there be people actually stationed on the bridge? Should they patrol the bridge so that people can intercede rather than, you know, put up higher fences or whatever, you know, structural things they do to try to stop people?
Well, so – So that's a great question, and that leads me to this. My father, after I did what I did, founded the Bridge Rail Foundation for the sole purpose of stopping suicides at the Golden Gate Bridge. It took 10 years and a lot of hard work and a great many families to have lost so many of their children, fiancés, loved ones, and friends to come forward and fight tooth and nail every day to stop the suicide problem at the Golden Gate Bridge by way of constructing a net. The Bridge Rail Foundation, along with its partners, found and legislated for, lobbied for funding from highway and transportation funding, mostly in municipal railway transportation funding and some other grants. And we have collected the funds, the $76 million to raise the net. And we have, and the bridge has done the environmental studies, and the net will be going up. Breaking ground starts this summer. The net will be in place on the Golden Gate Bridge by 2018 and no later. And it is understood that the mechanism of the net will not allow for one more person to die by design off the Golden Gate Bridge. But Senator, it was a long road and a hard road, and people didn't want the rail because they didn't want to ruin the beauty of the bridge. And so to that, Senator, I say, what is the beauty of a piece of iron compared to just one human life? Compared to one human life.
Biden, you know, I not only agree with you, but I understand that because there's absolutely no political issue out there that doesn't have opposition of some sort. And, you know,
you better believe it. Yeah, that's right.
And you think to yourself, boy, this is such a no-brainer that we should do something. But then there's always somebody on the other side. It's amazing. It amazes me sometimes. But I'm glad you've gotten that through, because I'm all about architectural beauty, but saving lives is saving lives. I mean,
the county board of supervisors, right, that you had to go through, Kevin, in order to make that
actually,
get approved.
Actually, the bridge is a private entity run by lobbyists of all kinds. And it's a board of directors of 16 individuals that for the longest time fought against this. And we would go to hearing after hearing after hearing and be disrespected. And, you know, I said to the director at one point, there was a toddler who was not holding his mother's hand. And he fell through the cracks of the. There used to be a gap between the sidewalk and the driving area, and this individual, this boy, fell through that gap, and of course he died. In 3 weeks, the gap was closed from front to back of the 2 mile bridge, without one public comment, without one ask for interest, and without one opposing issue, and they did it without asking anybody or anyone in San Francisco whether they cared about it or not. And I said to the board in a public trial, I said, why would you do that for him, which was the right thing to do, and for his family, but they were being sued, so they were worried about that as well.
Right.
And I said, and you wouldn't do that for people like me. And the individual that I asked that question to on the board in front of everyone on camera said, because that toddler was innocent. And thanks. I said, so I'm guilty, and silence. And that was all caught on camera. And it was a terrible moment for me, because it hurt so deep. And are we saying that all suicidal people are to blame for their crisis? And it just, right. And so now we are here where we are today. The net will be built. There will be no more deaths at the bridge, but they won't even close the walkway in the meantime. So roughly between now and 2018, we're looking at 40 to 60 deaths a year for the next 3 years before we stop this atrocity.
Because it's a steel net that they're building or creating, correct?
It's a metal encoded plastic net. So it's a plastic, it's a very thick, very durable type of plastic netting that is coated in steel or coated in some other kind of metal. And it renders you motionless because if anyone was to fall into this, they would be injured. They would not be harmed fatally, but they would be injured. And all around the world, I don't know if you know this, but where there are nets like this in place, there are bridges that have nets like this in place. And because people get injured, nobody jumps into it. And I'm talking about going from several suicides a year in these other places around the world to zero. And the only issue here is if the Bay Bridge doesn't do something soon, the situation might transfer. But if we were to actively react to bridges being put up like the Bay Bridge was so quickly, or without thought of a person in desperate need, without thought of the 80 years of death at the Golden Gate Bridge, these things wouldn't occur. People always said, well, they'll just go somewhere else. Well, if you give them a place to go, yes, but if you stop these things from happening, what happens is reduction of access to lethal means is actually what saves lives. That's been proven in many other situations besides jumpings. There was in England decades ago, maybe even a century, there was a gas oven that people were using to die. Once they switched the apparatus from gas to a different form of heat, and it was impossible to put your head into to die, suicides went down in that area. And guess what? They went down in the metropolitan areas around that area because the people, instead of dying, were asking people closest to them for help.
Well, let me ask you, Kevin, how did the demons go away, or how do you deal with the demons that you were unable to deal with at 19? Now that you're 35 or so, how what's changed in your life that allows you to, as you say, be snapped back into reality and remain there?
Senator, a lot of hard work. I have all of the symptoms I described earlier, the psychosis, the hallucinations, the depression, the mania, the paranoia. What I also have now are tools to stay stable, and those tools include exercising every day, eating healthy brain foods that feed my brain so I can keep my brain well. You know, in this country, the organ that is the most important, we neglect the most. Our brain health is just as important as every other organ in our body below the neck, and it has to be healthy for it to survive. So I educate myself about all the new findings in bipolar disorder so that I can try the newest treatments and therapies on a regular basis. I read things like Bipolar Hope magazine, which is just a magazine that is so phenomenal. It's a thin magazine that comes biweekly that allows you to learn every new bit of information on bipolar disorder. I'm a member of the International Bipolar Foundation. I'm a board member, an active board member. The International Bipolar Foundation is dedicated to helping those with bipolar disorder stay here, stay well, and stay productive, as well as it helps people in great need. I do everything I can in public advocacy, in private advocacy for myself, going to therapies, seeing a counselor. I use blue wave light box technology, which is a great form of treatment, a proven form of treatment for bipolar disorder and seasonal affective disorder. I eat, this is going to sound silly, but hear me out. I eat 24 or a handful of sunflower seeds, unsalted raw sunflower seeds, out of the shell every day, because the oils in sunflower seeds actually act as a natural low-grade antidepressant.
Really?
Yes, they do. I take a multivitamin that has been proven to work in bipolar disorder moods, called N-acetylcysteine, or what is called NAC. It's a natural element found in the body, and you just recreate it in pill form, and you take it twice a day as prescribed by your doctor, and it helps me stabilize my brain health. I still have all those symptoms. I still get suicidal. I have what is called chronic suicidal ideation. But I commit to life. I'll never let it kill me. I will never die by suicide. People say to me, how can you say that in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now? Because I will be learning more about bipolar disorder as the newer findings come out. I will be utilizing every new treatment that makes sense for my body and my mind, and I will fight tooth and nail for the rest of my life with this disease, because it is a disease. We call it an illness, but it's nonsense. It's chronic. It derives from an organ in the body. It's a disease. And, you know, we treat every disease from the neck down. Like, you know, people go visit you. They bring you cards, greeting cards. They bring you cups of soup. They bring you a conversation. They visit you every day. But let me ask you this. When was the last time you saw a family visit every day to a child or friend in the psych ward? You don't, because it doesn't happen. In seven psych wards between 2000 and 2011, I saw so many people that I deemed in my book, Crack Not Broken, the Forgotten, because no one was coming to see them at all.
Let me ask you about your family, because the one personal experience I have with someone in my church who I was close to, whose son committed suicide, and the son committed suicide at 48 years old. His parents were very angry about it. They were very angry about it. They felt that he had let them down and let his family down. But what can families do to intervene before all this happens?
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky. I have a great family that took the time to educate themselves about my struggles, you know. I mean, quite frankly, my mother, the day I jumped, was in a seminar on bipolar disorder and depression trying to learn about me. My father has since gone to the NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, Family to Family class, the 12-week course with me years ago, learning about depression, bipolar disorder, and how to help me fight it. My family read Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder, the book, which is an amazing book. I read and I shared with my family the book Bipolar for Dummies by Joe Cranach and Candida Fink. I got to be a part of that third edition of that book that just came out recently. And so I got lucky with my family backing me up. But what families can do, if they have the thought, the tiny inclination that their loved one is suicidal, let me make it crystal clear. You must ask the blunt question. You must ask the individual, are you currently in danger of suicide? And people say to me all the time, well, won't they just get that thought in their mind if you put it out there like that? That notion is a myth. That notion is nonsense. If you said to someone, do you have diabetes, would that make them have diabetes? No, it's a similar reaction. You tell someone, are you in danger of suicide? They tend to look at you if they're not and say, get away from me, man. That's ridiculous. Why would you even ask me that? I'm offended. But when you tell someone who is suicidal, are you in danger of suicide? They look at you and they begin to cry and they say, how did you know? How did you see the pain I was going through? And you've just given them permission to tell their truth. Now, the reality is, if they say they have a plan, you better be ready to sit down and listen with open ears and open arms, without judgment and with 100% empathy to what they are going through. Remember, this isn't about you if you have a family member with suicidal ideations. It's about them and their internal brain struggles. This is about chemistry in the brain. This is about someone battling inner self that is devastating their entire being. And the idea that people who are suicidal are selfish and letting people down is absolutely ridiculous. I understand how a family would feel that way. I get it. I can empathize with that feeling. What I can't empathize with is not educating yourself to the fact that the reality is it's not selfish. These people are battling such a great pain. And this is not, you're not talking about physical pain that you have and it goes away. We're talking about a pain that lasts, that sticks, that stays and doesn't move. And it becomes worse and worse and worse over time of not being treated. And it leads to suicide. Depression leads to suicide. Just like cancer leads to death, so does depression.
Is there
so
a
Kevin,
website?
I don't know if you know that I'm getting my master's in clinical psychology at the moment, wow. So I only know academically what it is that you're referring to because I haven't started doing my practicum yet. It's supposed to start this month. But they say and echo exactly what you just said about asking the question. That's not going to make a suggestion. It's not going to give them permission. It's checking it out. And then do they have a plan and is it imminent? And
right.
I want to thank you for sharing that from the trenches because I've been learning it in the hallowed halls of academia, and they say exactly what you just said.
Listen, Maria, had anyone looked at me and said, are you having suicidal thoughts? I would have told them the truth. All I wanted was for someone to really see me, see my pain, and say something.
Kevin, I'm sorry. What I was going to ask you, since education is obviously such an important part of this process, if we know that someone is suffering from bipolar or severe depression, is there a website we can go to where we can get information? Is there any kind of gateway website people can...
Yes, absolutely. And it's what
tell
I mentioned
what
earlier.
That is.
International Bipolar Foundation. IB as in boy, P as in Paul, F as in Frank, .org. IBPF.org. This is run by a woman named Muffy Walker. The board chair is a woman named Lori Butler. And the people on this board are the most formidable thinkers besides myself on bipolar disorder, how to treat it, how to fight it, and how to use tools that we all have inside of us to stabilize. Wellness tips, wellness tools. I'm actually writing a program with them right now on how I lived, learned, and stay as mentally stable as I can, able to go into these places and give speeches even when my paranoia is running rampant. You know, how do we – we're only going to learn about how to succeed while living with these kinds of diseases from the brain. We're only going to learn how to succeed with them by the people who have actually been there. You know, it's of great importance that we study it. Research is of the utmost importance so that we can learn how to fight it. But you're not going to learn how to beat it until you talk to someone who's been there.
So, well, Kevin, you've got lots of projects that we had said that we would like to help you promote. Why don't you speak about them? You've mentioned your book. Why don't you go into a little bit detail more?
Yeah,
please?
No, sure. So currently, I am in the process of directing and producing a film called Suicide, The Ripple Effect. It is a global effort of searching around the world for people who are, as I call them, preventers of suicide and givers of hope. These are individuals who are sharing their stories of hope and despair with light at the end of the tunnel, that are helping people all around the world in different spots, Japan, Australia, Ireland, London, England, you know, helping people stay alive, helping people stay here. These are individuals of different ages, races, and all kinds of backgrounds who are sharing stories of battling addictions to battling the pain of a former sexual assault, to fighting bipolar disorder, to fighting schizophrenia and beyond. And they're sharing their stories so that other people can find the fight within them to keep on keeping on. And the film takes us to talking to an Aboriginal man named Joe Williams out of Australia, who not only fights his mental health, but he battles an epic amount of racism and prejudice in his homeland that he and his people inhabited 60,000 years before Europeans. And his story is amazing. To coming over to England and talking to a man named Robert Walters, who nearly laid on the tracks and disappeared, and who reached out to me years ago in suicidal crisis. And I did everything I could for the next year and a half, only via written conversations on YouTube to keep this young man alive until he finally gave me his mother's information so I could get him to some actual help from all the way across the pond. To people in America like Ashley Hunt, who runs Infinite Strength, which is a program that gives women empowerment after sexual assault and helps them get back in to life and living. To a man named Travis Pipes, who came to me under the addiction of alcohol, the disease of alcoholism, drug addiction. And for about a year and a half, I tried my best to, as the same with Robert Walters, to help, just try and help keep him here. I always say that I don't have the power to save life. None of us do in a suicidal crisis. What we have the power to do is instill hope so people can find that glimmer, so they can grasp onto it, so they can change their lives themselves. And so the film is about that. It's about transformation.
Let me ask you, Kevin, as a politician, what can we do as a society? What can politicians do? What kind of legislation would help?
Yeah, no. You know, I mean, legislation for better funded programs so that people have more places to go that are readily accessible to as many human beings as possible. That's what we need. We need organizations and politicians to come together on Hill Day for the National Council for Behavioral Health coming up pretty soon. I'll be there in Washington, D.C., marching on Washington with Hill Day officials from all over the United States and even the world with the National Council of Behavioral Health, a great organization that is that are pioneers in the field of behavioral health, and they're working with politicians right now. And we'll be marching into the Capitol to sit down with politicians of all kinds, trying to persuade them to fight for these different kinds of laws that are benefiting people in mental crisis and their families. But, you know, to do so, we need to fix the funding that is consistently ripped from mental health, as in, oh, it's the first thing to go because it's not that important. Well, I ask you this, think about it for a minute. If we put money into brain health and mental health on a regular basis, you would have less people in jails. It would cost less money. You would have less people in psych wards, cost less money. You would have less people dying from depression, cost less money in funeral costs and family output of funds to solve all those problems. Overall, if politicians put funding where their mouths were in mental health, the dynamic of our society would change. There'd be less people on the street. There'd be less people stealing for food because they're too hungry. There would be less people in trouble mentally because they would be given the ability and the structure to stabilize.
So did you mention when the date is with the march with the National Council of Behavioral Health?
I will. Just one moment. I've got to ask my wife. Pardon me.
Okay. So, Michael, there you go. First hand, real time in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. When is it again? Give it to us.
He's looking for it.
It's June 6th and 7th.
All right.
On June 6th, Hill Day occurs on Washington. I'm a National Council ambassador myself, and the next day will be the International Bipolar Foundation breakfast on the state of bipolar disorder in America.
Wow, that's heavy.
Yeah,
well,
it really is.
We're trying to help.
Well, so, we should get everybody out there on. Can people join you on June 7th?
So you want to go to the National Council for Behavioral Health website?
Yeah.
And you'll see it on there. If you just type in National Council for Behavioral Health, you'll see all the information you need to find there. And if you want to help the film, it's suicidetherippleeffect.com, and that's EFFECT.com. We're currently raising funds to finish the film. I'm just trying to do – I feel like I'm a speck in the sand. I want to help people the best way I know how, and that's by telling my stories.
Well,
so Kevin,
I'm sorry, Michael, the
documentary Suicide, the Ripple Effect, are you also looking for more stories to cover?
Or just
more funds?
Just more funding to finish the stories and to – we are looking for stories to be told in a proper suicide prevention safe messaging kind of way on Suicide the Ripple Effect Facebook page. That we are looking for, and people are sharing their stories. And the greatest thing about that is that so many people come up from under those stories and write comments of hopefulness and kindness and healing, as opposed to this negativity we so much see on the web these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you do all this naturally, Kevin? I mean, do you take any pharmaceuticals? Are you prescribed medication?
That's part of my treatment plan. I do take medications that help me. I've been on a regimen right now for some time that I found does work, but you know, Senator, it took me 8 years to find the right ones. And sometimes people don't find them at all, and sometimes they don't work for people. I'll tell you this though, if I take them with 100% accuracy every day, at the same time every day, so I don't mess up my routine.
That's
which I understand is part of the key, right? To keep the consistency and to keep your levels constant and to keep a routine so that there's some kind of sameness, if you will, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, routine is necessary. I remember being in my third psych ward and my Uncle George coming to see me and him handing me over a Time magazine article on bipolar disorder and depression. And this was in... this was when I was 23. This was in 2004. And this article was one of the first of its kind to be talking about routine to help heal brain health. And today, I've written my own program that's in Huffington Post magazine, about how I stay alive when my brain's trying to kill me.
I've read most of that because you have been a fascinating story for me and an honor and a privilege to know. And, you know, some of us think we've got bad days or we've got the blues or, you know, seasonally affected disorder or what have you. And your story makes all of those pale, not to mean that it's not also injurious or it doesn't hurt. But I've just admired your tenacity, and you have a wife, and you've got relationships, and you've got commitments, and you've got professional and boards and everything else, and then you still have your struggles.
Yeah, you know, and you know what, Maria? It's all good because I get to be here. I look at life so much differently now, Maria. You know, a near-death experience will do that to you. I look at life like everything matters today. Everything, from every place I've gone, every person I've met, and everything I get the privilege of doing. It's all a gift. And it was almost taken away from me, Maria, and I won't allow this disease to do that to me again, even when it's hard, even if I have to go right back into a psych ward. I will take care of my brain health because I've got people that depend on me. And I realized the wake of destruction my actions caused in my path. And, you know, you guys, I lived. I got to live. And
let me ask you, Kevin, in some strange way, does that take the pressure off a little bit that you say to yourself, I shouldn't be here right now. I'm here. This is a gift. Does that somehow take away some of the pressure? You know what I mean?
You know, I look at it in the opposite direction. It almost puts a responsibility on my shoulders that is pretty heavy because I've had people write to me and say the things like, you know, well, if you can do it, so can I. And what they're also writing to me and saying is, as much as they're saying kind things, is they're saying, if you ever can't do it, I won't be able to. I've had people say that to me. And so it's to quote Spider-Man, with great, power comes great responsibility. And what I mean by that is not power in the sense of that we think it, but this, you know, the power of the human voice. We all have a story. Not all of us have to tell it to everyone. But for those of us who have these lived expertise, and this lived experience, and for those of us that are fighting to help others in this field, you know, my wife and I are co-founders of the United Survivors Movement, a group trying to bring suicide attempt survivors and those who have lost a loved one to suicide together to couple that lived experience to push forward a movement saying, now, if you're going through it, you come to us, we'll battle it together. And not only will we battle it together, we will fight for social justice and for this global civil rights movement.
I certainly
Kevin,
understand
would you
that.
Indulge me? Michael, I think you're going to appreciate this, and if I'm hoping that my memory is serving me correct, because Michael and I are both Catholic, and I believe you are too, Kevin. But you had a member of the clergy visit you in the hospital when you were recovering. Would you share that story, please?
Maria, I was in the hospital in the psych ward at St. Mary's Psych Ward, the first psych ward I'd ever been in. I was terrified. I was in a down place, and a Franciscan friar, Brother George Cherry, who looks like St. Francis without the birds on his shoulders, you know, with the robe and the right rope and all that stuff. He came in, and he always would check the charts on the door, but he didn't today, that day. And he comes in, jovial, smiling from ear to ear, and he says, hey, kid, what are you in for? And I said, brother, I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he goes, oh, yeah, and I'm the Pope. He didn't believe me. And I said, no, brother, that's what happened. And he comes over to my left side. He says, oh, I'm so sorry. I feel so silly. And he says, let's pray. And he pulls out a red rosary. And he puts a hand on my forehead. And he says a prayer with me. And then he says, when you get better, you ought to talk about this. And Maria, Senator, I said to him, about what to who? I got out of the psych ward a month later, after healing for a month physically before that. And my father and I went to the church I grew up in, St. Cecilia's Church in San Francisco, the coupling school I had gone to as a kid. The priest there had confirmed me as a kid, and he ended up marrying my wife and I later on. Good man, Father Michael Harriman. And I go into church, and, you know, it's over, and you walk outside, and I'm in my cane and my back brace. I'm hobbling all around. My dad's helping me down the stairs. And Father Harriman at the time, who's now a Monsignor, comes over to me and says, Kevin, how would you like to come and talk to our kids about your experience on Good Friday? Maria, it hadn't been 7 months past my attempt when he asked me to do this. And I looked at him and I said, oh, Father, I don't have a speech, and I would not know what to say. And my father, who's 6'1", and I'm 5'7", took his oven mitt-sized hands, shoved me from the back forward, and said, he'll do it. And I looked at my dad and I said, what are you doing? He goes, you'll do it. We need closure. And at the time, I'm thinking, well, Dad, you need closure, but I don't need to do this. And I looked at the priest and said, see you on Good Friday. So it was reluctant how I got into this. And I go to Good Friday. I talk to 120 seventh and eighth grade kids, all sitting cross-legged on the floor in front of me at the rectory, in their uniforms that I used to wear. And I'm thinking, who is this going to help? I mean, you guys, you have to see the picture here, okay? I'm reading it from the page. I'm dropping page by page to the floor. I am crying the entire time. I'm shaking like a mouse. I'm a mess all the time throughout the speech, thinking, what am I doing here? Well, 2 weeks later, I was called to the rectory to pick up 120 letters from 120 kids. And several of them wrote in their letters that they were actively suicidal. But because they were under age of 18, minors, those letters were screened before they got to me. And we were able to find help for those kids. And those kids, it's my understanding, are still alive today. And I didn't do that. They heard a glimmer of hope. They grasped onto a piece of light, and they chose to stay here. So, you know, it's a calling for me as much as a calling would be for a clergyman. This is my calling.
Well, we're glad that you found your calling, Kevin, and that you're still with us and that you're bringing hope to others. I want to thank you for being on the show. We're out of time. Okay. It goes by quickly when you have an interesting guest. I hope you'll come back and join us again sometime. Give us an update on what happened in June when you came to Washington. Again, thanks very much. And I hope folks will tune in next week for our Emancipation Day show. Maria, what do you want to say?
Just to thank Kevin again. And KevinHinesStory.com is also a great resource with a lot of information about Kevin and his amazing journey. Kevin, thank you so much. Have a great, safe travels and a blessed week.
Thank you, guys. You guys have a great night.
You too.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you, Michael.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.